So thank you all for stilling and pooling our atmosphere and making a web. I can certainly feel it. And I'm going to need to rely on the help of it to do something this afternoon which is admittedly risky, as if the rest of it isn't. But what I want to do is a little bit to raise some places of areas of question in the way that we have been configuring our understanding and approach to the pandemic, of the information sources, the way we configure the playing field. And I want to do this cautiously because what I very much want to avoid, and as a matter of fact, we'll ring the bell to stop it, is any kind of reconstructing together of what's right. Somebody bringing up this article they've read, somebody else bringing up that article, and so we pour ourselves into a collective wiseacring. That isn't my point tonight. What I want to do is just to raise some places where I think that our approach on all sides has been subject to what Gurdjieff would call formatory thinking and bias, and to raise places where a picture might be constructed in a different way without trying to construct that picture. And I'm going to stay for today within our planet. I'm not going to too much bring in the whole kind of overarching picture of the ray of creation, which I think is ultimately the place from which the large enough picture will come. But to just look at what we're dealing with, and as a way of essentially priming the pump and beginning to sharpen our questions as we meet with Eva Lee tonight. So the section on hypnotism that I referred to before in Gurdjieff's book, because it was from that section that I read the part about the being foods. It starts with a wonderful, wonderful description of an academic phenomenon which he calls pecking to death. And of course, the chapter begins with quite a kind of deep bow to Mesmer, of mesmerism, who Gurdjieff really paints in this as a good cosmic servant who is trying to work between the worlds to develop a way to heal illness. It says, but later, when he began making practical experiments to clear up certain details, it was then that there was manifested toward him a particularity proper to the learned beings of new formation there. This particularity of terrestrial learned beings of new formation is called pecking to death. As this honest Austro-Hungarian learned being conducted his experiments, not as all the learned scientists of the new formation had become mechanized to do, he was, as is the custom there, pecked to death. And the process of pecking to death of this poor Mesmer was so effective that for nearly two centuries it has been continued from generation to generation among the learned beings of the earth. The more the contemporary learned beings of the peculiar planet are idiots squared, the more they criticize Mesmer and say or write every possible kind of absurdity to discredit him. And in doing this, they criticize just that honest and humble learned being of their planet who, if he had not been pecked to death, would have received the only science which is absolutely necessary for them, and by means of which alone they might perhaps be saved from the consequences, of the organ kunda buffer, this wonderful thing Gurdjieff imagines was installed in us to keep us docile and manipulable. There is no harm in noting here that just before I left that planet forever, precisely the same thing had occurred to this Vesper was being repeated there. On this occasion, the victim was an honest and humble learned being belonging to the community of France, who after persistent and conscientious labors came across the possibility of curing that terrible disease so widely spread in recent times that it now exists on a general planetary scale. This terrible disease is called cancer. As this Frenchman also made practical experiments to elucidate the details of this discovery, not in the customary way, other contemporary scientists therefore manifested toward him that same particularity of pecking to death. And so without sort of over generalizing on this, and I'm wondering who that French person is. Is it Curie? Is it, did anybody get a, who's a Beelzebub nut, figure that out? But essentially, when we color outside the lines in what consists of what we consider to be a higher knowledge and the processes undergirding it from what Gurdjieff calls learned beings of the new formation, we get pecked to death. And so it becomes very, very hard to insert any new opinions or any new perspectives which aren't variations on a theme. So at the moment, the playing field has gotten itself configured, so it looks like the good guys and the bad guys. And the good guys are the guys that are the responsible medical scientists, the people who are educated, and that wonderful collusion of people that, in all due respect, and since Buddy's not in the room right now, congregate around the CDC, the Red Dawn, the highest medical practice, the God knows what influence of Big Pharma, but constitute the body of what we would call responsible scientific truth that is brought to bear on the disease. And from this disease, from this sort of viewpoint, the news filters down through basically our liberal progressive channels, our more intelligent journalism, our thoughtful articles, that paint a portrait of what this disease is, how it is, and how responsible people react to it to control it, work with it, and eventually conquer it. So we got that side, and I would dare say that most of the people in this room belong to that camp. You come to that camp by virtue of your education, your formation, your intelligence. And then across this is the radical rowdies that we could demonize around, let's just put it in there, the Fox News. And the whole group that basically poo-poos the whole thing. And then, could they possibly hire Donald Trump to come up with the stunts he comes up with? How did one wag get it? A spoonful of Clorox, that's keeping the pandemic go down. The pandemic go down. The idea of this sort of what you might call the radical restlessness, the bring it on, let's put the crowds together, let's all go hug naked on Miami Beach, to hell with. So you get these polarized sides, and our side, the liberal, the wise, learned beings of the new formation draw back in horror and say, how could this rampant idiocy be allowed to take place? How could people be stupid enough to buy it without seeing at all the blind spots and the great failures in our own, in the alternative that we cleave to as as responsible discipline in science. So this is the quandary. And meanwhile, like in a two-party system everywhere, really generally alternative viewpoints get pecked to death. And some of them are wifty and some of them are not. But we have to begin, I think, by realizing that we are in a situation where we are not getting good information, even from the point of view of this planetary world, from the point of view of World 48, and that in the absence of them, we may be making some decisions which have very, very harmful effects, not only in World 48, but along the rest of the chain. In other words, we often come up with the wrong strategies. So rather than arguing that, I just want to raise a couple of points where I see questions and places where it would be important to pay attention in certain ways. And of course, I was starting with this a little bit last night, with the frame that we have been using to frame this disease right from the start is as an enemy. And that was carried right over today into an article that was, I guess, in the Wall Street Journal today. And Buddy shipped it to me. But it talks about, it characterizes the disease as diabolical. Diabolically clever, goes on for paragraphs and paragraphs about talking about how it's outsmarting science, feeding the thing that it will find your weak link and kill you there. But the whole stance is so patently adversarial. So patently builds on what we were already talking about yesterday about our increasing isolation from nature and from the natural world. And we talked about how we already are in a situation in America where we are probably the most over-medicated, over-sanitized, and over-sterilized and separated from our environment of most any peoples in the world. Again, with this idea that there's something strangely dangerous in the natural world and that we have to protect ourselves. So we're already building our responses on that skew, which is going to make it very, very hard to see any sort of the direction that Llewellyn von Lee was pushing in last night, of that we have to see that we are actually part of the biosphere and that this thing belongs as much as we do. And that the ways of framing it need to shift away from an anthropocentric viewpoint to at least a biocentric viewpoint. And we haven't been able to do that, and I see very little that emerges in the journalism of the quote responsible establishment that doesn't wind up with the effect of deepening our sense of fear, alienation, and hopelessness. Whatever is the intention of it, this seems to be the place where it winds up. You know, it's funny, without getting into this, we have a fellow who's the boat captain out on Eagle Island in the boat, and I watched him in full combat regalia this summer, that he's already terrified of Lyme's disease. Not because he's ever had it, because they told you the little beasties can get you if you leave any of your skin exposed. So he wears khaki pants with white knee socks, which he carefully pulls up over his khaki pants so that none of these bastards can crawl up his ankle. And then when he had to run the mail boat and take in all these godforsaken, potentially polluted tourists, you know, this huge bastard. So here he is in his little khaki pants, knee socks, belt drawn in, and mask. welcome to the planet. All you need is a gas mask, and I think these are not too long coming. Before you've become a walking symbol of our actual alienated stance from the mother in which we belong. So this is a sort, and against this, I think that scientists that are trying to look for a different starting point don't have a chance. And we sent around that interview for you to look at from Zach Bush. And I have to say that I have no basis on which to make an informed judgment about the reliability of that, and there's more than a few places where I've caught some of the tricks he's been up to. Again, there's nothing you can do without an editorial skew. But he is doing something interesting as the basis. He's trying to combine three fields of science. The first being, what is it, an epidemiologist?
Yeah.
Epidemiologist, a permaculture guy,
yeah.
And a hospice worker, also as an MD.
Researcher, yeah, he's researching.
Yeah, which gives him already a very, very different perspective, because he's already looking from the point of view of biodiversity and from the need and the, in some sense, the imperative of the cosmos to of the biosphere to maintain its own equilibrium. So he's looking at it differently, and from the perspective of this, he raised some things that other people have seen, but he begins to bring them into proportion. So it's fairly clear on the one hand there, he raises first of all the troubling questions of, you know, that from the start science was all deciding this is a respiratory illness. It's a respiratory virus, it attacks the lungs. And then the data began to come in more and more that what it has in common, and in common with the SARS, I believe, virus, is that its first symptomology seems to show up as what they call hypoxic injury. In other words, lack of oxygen. And that the lack of oxygen is caused because something in it interacts with the hemoglobin, the blood, in such a way that it can no longer bind oxygen. So that there was this one clip that Zach referred to in his movie that I actually went back and searched it from one of the doctors on the floor in the medical clinics in New York when everything was getting swamped, saying that that his patients were behaving like they were at 30,000 feet, and that what was going on was altitude sickness, the inability to draw oxygen in. And so of course when you have that, you have you're going to have putting them on a ventilator is the worst possible thing you could do, because if they can't draw oxygen in the first place, flooding their system with aggressive oxygen is simply going to kill them. So there was a strong sense that in all due science, in the highest and most, you know, the learned beings of the new formation missed an essential feature of this, and then created a treatment scheme which was lethal, and also failed because they weren't looking in the right places to see the common thread. Then we got all this, and then it finds the comorbidity in it, you know, and if you start by looking at the fact that it really its initial thing is a virus that causes, you know, tissue damage through hypoxia, then all the things that look like separate little nasty diabolic things it does come together in a more interesting thing. So that whole syndrome of misdiagnosis and mistreatment, even by those in positions of high authority because they're not looking at it. He says, yeah, it moves on and it progresses when it hits the lungs. it progresses to a respiratory illness, because when the lungs are dealing with this trauma, that's what they do. They fill up and they suffocate. And that's what people were diagnosing as the primary manifestation, but it was in fact the secondary. And, you know, my little granddaughter, Ava, certainly corroborated that when there was an undetected, undiagnosed outbreak at Wachusett High School in near Worcester, Massachusetts, late January, February, before anybody had COVID on the radar screen, you know, the Chinese flu, and her first symptom, she got it along with 2/3 of the school. Nobody died. Nobody was treated. Nobody went on respirators, ventilators. But she said the first thing she noticed was she was walking home from her job and she couldn't breathe. And from there it progressed, you know, 3 weeks in bed, you know, respiratory, the whole thing. But so there's a lot about what is this disease actually that we short-circuited by thinking we knew. And the misdiagnosis, and of course, as Zach pointed out, the our already long and illustrious history of isolating ourselves and over-medicating ourselves. We quickly decided that the old were vulnerable, but we didn't look further. We just assumed they were vulnerable because they were old, without also asking the question, many old people, particularly in this part of the world, are over-medicated, and a couple of the core medications they get for heart and for diabetes control block what little we have left of our immune system that would have been able to fight these diseases. So the old are sitting ducks, but not because they're old, because they've been over-medicated. But already the damage was done, and old people were, you know, cordoned off, and I've heard so many people tell me, you know, I'm vulnerable, I'm old. You know, I'm old too, but, you know. But anyway, so this is how it goes. Just again, looking at this syndrome of castles of assumptions building on other assumptions building on other assumptions. And I think that even today, as the news comes to us, I at least don't have access to the things where we're getting a complete picture of this disease. We get pictures of outbreaks. You know, the students come back to college and all of a sudden there's an outbreak at North Carolina State, or, you know, well, what do you expect? But then we hear nothing further about, well, how serious was it? What did it, you know, how was it fought against? How many who were tested positive got it? I haven't seen reliable statistics being generated at how well people are assimilating. I haven't seen a lot of comparative data about how countries are doing, the ones who meticulously hopped on the top protocols are doing vis-a-vis the ones that have been struggling. You mysteriously don't hear much about how it's faring in South America, or you'll hear an odd report about when it spikes, but we're you know, again, this thing of, oh, there's a new outbreak here, there's a new outbreak there, that's all we hear. Anyway, that's just a general thought of background. Zach also raised some very interesting questions which bear on things, again with his love of permaculture as one of his things, is he's paid a lot more attention than I think anybody else was first on not only the virus is airborne, before anybody was even talking about that, but also the virus as soil-borne. And the relationship between the symptoms that were presenting in hypoxia, the overlap with the similarity to the symptomology in cyanide poisoning, and then is it just an extraneous relationship between the amount of cyanide that's been going into our air in the past few years? Essentially, Zach is trying to make the case, and he overstates it, but I think it's in the right direction that what we're really seeing in this particular emergence of this virus, and in general in the increasing frequency and toxicity of viruses during just the period we've been talking about, has been a marker, a genomic mirror, as we talked about the other day, to the increasing atmospheric and Zach would add soil pollution of our planet. And what we're seeing is the biosphere, and particularly the microbiome, struggling to maintain biodiversity within the whole system, in other words, ecological balance, in rapidly changing conditions caused by our own human tampering with it. So the disease raids back on us. And he pointed out that, so that people in like Wuhan got control of the disease because they all went home and sheltered in place. But oh yeah, by the way, when they weren't driving their cars around madly, the air cleared up. And the cyanide, the cyanide was not quite so there. We haven't put those pieces together yet. The relationship between the disease as it's manifesting as an anthropocentric threat, and what have we fed in, and what are the stepping stones in the whole part of the biosphere that contribute to the conditions in which this pandemic is a completely legitimate and predictable response, adaptive response of the planet. So that's a little bit of the background. It's funny how Trump, for all of our wishing to castigate him, hits a couple of things sort of off the mark, but not completely out of the ballpark. I lie under my ultraviolet machine, but there is a clearly demonstrable effect of sun in neutralizing the virus, the outdoors, the sun. And I haven't followed that bleach hydrochloroxidine thing. But although adjusting bleach may be off the charts, there has been some incidents that the same sort of basic medication used in anti-malarial treatment has had some effect in places like India in keeping the mortality rate down as an alternative treatment. Anyway, without trying, as I said, to try and argue one point of view over the other, the idea is that getting partial information sometimes can be almost as lethal as getting no information. And the place, the two places where the rubber hits the road for me in the interface with the wisdom, with the wisdom stream we're working at, the imaginal stream, have to do with, first of all, the issue of air. And I'm going to be working more on air tomorrow in its sacred dimensions and the practices of Tonglen and others that are worldwide, sacred practices holding the holy nature of air and the healing nature of air at the forefront. But for the moment, I just want to ponder a little bit further the quandary that Mary Ellen nailed this morning, and that what we're up against. I think it would be insane to argue that the disease is not primarily transmitted by droplets. I mean, it manifestly is. And that I think it's been demonstrated over and over and over again around the world without any possibility of challenging it, that when you have massive contagions and those sort of super spreaders and all those things they talk about, the contributing factor is people, particularly inside in close quarters, interacting far too vigorously with each other. By physical contact, by you know, yelling, screaming, singing, loud, boisterous behavior, in which the final issue is that droplets are spread, and coughing and sneezing, and of course, and all the usual welcome to flu season. But that is our primary transmission. The spread is about 5 feet, they say, in a typical person who doesn't have projectile lung capacity. And so in that kind of a situation, the remediations which were immediately sought make sense. The 6 feet apart distancing, the masks to prevent the emission or ingestion of other people's droplets. And there is absolutely no question that they have proved highly effective in knocking the edge off what could otherwise be massive, you know, medical overwhelm. So there's no argument there. But then came this whole sort of next thing sneaking up, just when you think it's safe to go back in the water, and people began to discover aerosol, and that this wasn't just getting transmitted by droplets that we were breathing on each other, that somehow or another in close quarters it could also go into the air, and that particularly in rooms where we were close together and there was no ventilation, we could wind up taking in a finer species of that same COVID droplet from our fellow brothers and sisters. And so I think that's been the next scale of the escalation of the disease and the fear level, that is almost at this point paralleling what happened when Eva Lee discovered asymptomatic transmission. All of a sudden everybody panics, you know. When asymptomatic transmission was discovered, it was, oh my God, you could look healthy, but you could really be polluting me. Or I could look healthy and I could be polluting you, you know. So it's that whole boogeyman element entered, and I could watch that overnight in the town, that people were suddenly guilty till proven innocent. But with this aerosol now, that we're still working on the assumption that the transmitters of the human disease is human beings who are affected. And the aerosols mean that they're just massively more effective than we ever thought. And so everything is massively more dangerous. So what we're beginning to see now is, as Mary Ellen nailed it today, people afraid of the air. You know, walking around town in masks. I've seen at least a dozen people riding around town, single occupants in a vehicle, wearing their masks. As if, you know, and of course, outside, you know, even though the 6 foot distancing is more than observed, you know, it's like you mask in public, period, is becoming a way of life. Even amongst the most fearful of the most cautious of the disease experts, it's like mask in public if you can't separate by 6 feet. But now, you know, it's gotten like air. You know, these things could be floating around in the air, and we're still sort of saying, well, it's being transmitted by airplanes, it's being transmitted by cruise ships. But what Zach and others are saying is that, yes, it's airborne, and this may actually be our greatest salvation. if we can turn it the other way from how it looks like it's turning now. The way it looks like it's tearing now is because it grows up on a basis of already this oppositional, fearful attitude towards our environment. And so all of a sudden now the whole air is dangerous. I just gotta, you know, breathe through filters but Zach points out, you know, that if an airplane's gonna carry it somewhere, it's already gonna be there in the airwaves, the wind currents that are circling the globe. You know, it's like the bottom line is there's no place on this earth that COVID is not, because we are one earth circulated by one atmosphere. But that for most of the earth, and for most of it, including here in our beautiful little town, it's in relatively small doses, you know, around in the atmosphere. It's another thing in the atmosphere. And in those kinds of conditions, it can be handled, and in point, homeopathically ought to be handled. It's our opportunity to see, because air is something beautiful and volatile and sacred and unholy that can be worked with in a different way. Again, nonsensibly, non-recklessly, but this song, terror of the conditions of our incarnation, and that I swear I don't know if there's somebody who's actually working the mix at the responsible news channels, and for what purposes. But it seems that everything that I see put out in responsible journalism has the net effect of scaring us further. And I find myself asking why? Who's to profit from this? It seems to raise the suspicion levels, the separation levels, the sacred gestures that demonstrate to our fellow creatures either connectedness or lack of connectedness. It's increasing the gestures of lack of connectedness. And why? And so these are questions that trouble me. The thing that troubles me most from the imaginal point of view, and that I'm going to be working at tomorrow as we look at what actually happens, what is the nutritional value of virtues, if you want to put it that way, in terms of the cosmic feeding. What bothers me most is that human beings cannot not transform. We are always putting something into the atmosphere, whether we like to or not. There's always an emotional, vibrational signature to everything we do. That's part of the point of the atmosphere's exercise. You know, that if we put in agitation is what reverberates. And as we put in fear, as we put in self-protection, as we put in manipulability, these elements are out there. One of the funny things, if you watch it, is you could say that we responsible citizens are being herded. You know, back where we were told that it was a primary manifestation, a primary channel of transmission was through contact with surfaces. Oh my God, overnight all of the hand sanitizer disappeared from the, you know, toilet paper was rationed, not a bleach bottle in town, and people were buying gloves, and you know, you never saw anybody do anything without gloves, and so, you know. And then somebody said, oh no, it's not so bad that way, and the gloves came off and the bleach came back on the shelf, but now it's aerosols. And so all of a sudden we have a whole designer industry around masks. Cute little masks, but they got all their little carbon filters in them now, just discreetly hiding, and you know. And God, the mask industry has just taken off. I wish I had some stock in it. But because you know, we're so damn manipulable because of this fear. And the problem for me really, you know, these things have emotional signatures and you can watch them having an effect on the atmosphere of a town, on the atmosphere of a group, on its courage, on its imagination. And I watch those effects and they break my heart. And I watch as well the effects of a certain kind of deceit wash out my mouth with soap, because there's no way you can prove it except by smelling it. And if people don't believe that virtues have a smell, then you can get away with lying. But what became very, very quickly one of the leading kind of Christian religious spiritual stances is, oh, no, I'm not doing it to protect me, I'm doing it to protect you. I think there's a sign like that on our door, my mask protects you, your mask protects me. And the net gain is self-protection. But this whole idea that this was really compassion and courtesy. And yes, it has a component of that, for sure. And I think there are many, many people in situations that would mask up out of precisely that sense of respect and compassion. I watched it beautifully around this town with the people that were keeping the general store. And some of those folks were really scared to come to work. And they had to come to work because they had bills to pay, you know, and it was an essential industry. And the townspeople of the town, even your kind of your rowdiest Trumpies that wouldn't be caught dead in a mask, would mask up at the store as a sign of love and solidarity for their neighbors. So that part is true. But I also see an awful lot of self-protection, masking, literally, as courtesy and compassion. And a lot of kind of ritualistic behavior taking over, that my granddaughter Zoe, who's 17 out in Los Angeles in California, you know, in a school that's, you know, very angsty and very liberal progressive and microaggressions and politically correct and race justice and, you know, all the right political sentiments. They're trying to have sleepovers again. But the rules are they all have their separate bedroom and they bring their own dinners in bags and they eat them in separate plates. And Zoe, just to be super solicitous in the group, had a COVID test first and came back negative, so she went to the party. And so people were given gloves to wear when they went into the bathroom and masks to wear when they went into the bathroom. And she came out without her gloves, and the other girls jumped all over her because she wasn't following the protocol. She says, "Guys, I tested negative." but after a while, the symbols become so imbued with the sacramental value of what they're symbolizing that people can't tell the difference. You know? And two COVID negative people hugging each other is looked upon as a social sin. And when you see that kind of behavior developing around people, you know that the thing has got a hook in your soul, mm-hmm. in a place that just isn't healthy. And so for me, the questions being really raised by this are, what is this disease? What's its nature scientifically, you know, enzymatically or microbiologically? What are the responses that help? What are the responses that just reify ritualized fear behavior? What behaviors allow us to go forward for the long haul? And this is without even adding in the whole question that we're going to get to tomorrow. What nutrients are available to us from realms above for healing, for replenishing, and for regrouping if we can somehow cut through this threshold of the fear paradigm, which is really being forced upon us consistently in the name of responsible science. So that's the quandary, and I would simply want to state once again that it's not either or, and that the real goal in this is just pushing a little bit harder with hard questions and for pieces of the puzzle and for raising the question of it's not a one-size-fits-all, that in a world where webs do exist, that parts of the world which are more hard besieged, you know, where you really have the thing percolating, a different kind of level of response is probably warranted from other parts of the world who, by virtue of the web, can help by channeling different things in. So these are potentials for wisdom seekers to at least think about. And my hope in inviting Eva to speak with us tonight is first of all to continue to be educated by someone who is a very responsible, learned being of the new formation. You know, her scientific models and her consortium, you know, are what we would call the blue chip in this country for responsible hard science management of this disease. But Eva sees some other things from the point of view of her own sort of natural heart, and that she hasn't, I think, integrated entirely. I mean, I don't know how far the two streams of her life have begun to flow together yet, but she does understand that there's something off in the mix with our over-sanitized, over-processed, over-protective, over-adversarial relationship to nature. And where she's going to go with that, I don't know. But anyway, those are just a few of the things that are in the back of my own head as we draw a group together that's willing to entertain some different perspectives, ask some different questions, and see if is any third force out there, not just for the healing of the pandemic, but for the healing of the country in this time where all we're getting is simplistic takes on both sides, similar only in their own sense of their absolute rectitude. So that's all I wanted to present this afternoon, and I thought we might spend the rest of the time before adjourning just with any kinds of reflections on the day, questions, or as I said, I don't want to get into the, you know, Cynthia science versus everybody's science, is Zach Bush for real? These questions could draw down the energy of the web, and they're good things for you to do, to sit and have when you're talking in your small groups, but I don't want to do that right now in this group. But what I would be interested in hearing is any sort of insights or takeaways from the material of this morning, or anything that's been presented, anything on your hearts and minds. Yeah, Bill?
Changing the subject a little bit, but maybe not that much. I have to say, and this was true too when I was in the Gurdjieff work, I continue to be confused by the law of seven.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if maybe you might give a little guidance here as to where, what to look at. It seems to me that there were two levels that you were speaking of. One is the general function that the planet as a whole, the biosphere, whatever we want to call it, plays in the cosmic scale. The other one is much more personal, having to do, or at least group social process. With respect to the latter, I find it really difficult to know what's what and where is what. Because everything seems sort of bound together. I mean, to give an example, we have global communication that allows us to it's relatively recent. It's in our lifetime of the people that are here. That's bound up, we had an earlier example, Tim mentioned, there was a global compassion that we were talking about. Millions of people that were affected by it all over the last night. That's a new thing to some degree in our human consciousness as well. On the other hand, we also have it's become a new way of extending the consumer society.
Mm-hmm.
So all those are sort of bound in. And where do you identify? Where do you touch the put that light extra touch on the me or on the
me fa? How do you know it?
How do you separate those things out?
Yeah, well, that's one of those Rilkean live the questions things, and I think that one thing that Gurdjieff insisted about the law of three and the law of seven, since they were, for him, really cosmic laws, is that they are valid in all domains, at all scales, across the board. So it's as true at the very personal as it is at the microcosmic, as it is at the macrocosmic and the societal. But I think the difficulty is that as he tried to realize this, And you've got a whole kind of selection of people that just dive down the rabbit hole he gave us to try and explain how the law of seven and law of three interact and keep on spiraling to create these successive octaves of work and carbons and hydrogens and oxygens and how we digest and how we ingest and it's brilliant, and I have great admiration for the people who can actually slug their way through it. But I get, either get lost or get dazed over pretty fast. So I've never dipped too closely into the bath or the chemistry of the food factory, which I tend to take of, as a kind of pseudoscience because I don't know anything about it. That when you had people like Keith Bozell, who lived right here in Maine and was a medical doctor and studied it for 50 years of his life, he came out with some really, really interesting things. And I would recommend to you his book about the third striving, to get probably the state of the art, the best thing I've ever seen, trying to put some mathematical and chemical sense to it. That being said, I mean, the question of how do you know where you're on a real mi-fa shock point and whether it's just more cultural froth? It's really hard to discern from the outside. And I think a lot of the work that we're really being called to do is to lighten up on the horizontal dimension of our global connectedness in order to avail ourselves more of a depth dimension that's always been there, but requires a certain collection of being to see it, that that when you said that this global communication is new, well, it's not new at all. It's new in the expression that we're giving it nowadays, with everybody sitting in their computers and you know, and dialing in the world. But the whole idea behind the conscious circle of humanity is that it's instantaneously possible through the web, through the cosmic, the metaphysical web, to be in contact non-locally with everybody else who's working in the same way, whether you know them or not. You know, the atmospheres mix, meld. You know, there is a connection that happens. We just can't see it, and we can't kind of savor it horizontally. And that in some sense our fascination with the horizontal dimension has begun to erode a capacity for depth knowing that has been part of the human possibility up till this point. And a lot of the challenge of the wisdom school is to rename that dimension and retrain people that work in it. So that's not much of an answer, but it comes back to the contemplative roots of as we look within with three-centered awareness, some of the things that we don't see see us and claim us.
I think I understand that, Cynthia. I've had some experiences with people who've had an ability to communicate without but it seems as if though as part of human evolution, if I could call it that, it's been we have an access to forms of communication that we did not have before.
Exactly. And what are we going to do with them?
Oh, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
What is the responsible use of them?
It's a very difficult question.
You know, and I'm really interested because Ilya Delio's gang at the Omega Institute are trying to put together an all Zoom online Omega conference this year that they're really trying to design so that it's Zoom friendly. So that rather than just doing what everybody does and show those little arrays of pictures of everybody there in little boxes, they're really trying to think about what it is as an energetic medium and work with it so that it doesn't exhaust viewers and so it interacts with them. In other words, they're taking seriously that it's not just an expedient platform, but it's an art form. So I think that's an interesting development. When I look tomorrow about air and electricity and some of these items, we'll see more about, you know, are there limits? Is this, you know, do we have anything to fear from the proliferation of the atmosphere, which is really our connecting link in some ways between the realms, with the supportive technology that allows this feast of horizontal communication here. I don't know. Robert Sardello is very, very freaked about that. And I have deep, deep respect for Robert Sardello. He hasn't been able to make a case in a way that doesn't sound like voodoo. You know, and there's this whole group of people that are out there that are just panicked about being underneath, the towers, the cell towers. So that little thing is going on, but it hasn't caught any cachet yet. Not because necessarily because it's false, but because nobody wants to hear it. You know. But so we don't know yet, and I can't claim to do anything except share with you a couple of things that both Thalberg and Gurdjieff were saying about there were cautions and warnings here. So we don't know exactly what we're getting into there. We won't figure out the morality of our worldwide communication guaranteed until we bring in the imaginal realm. And and look at what happens to the BFA connection in a disturbed electromagnetic field. And I don't have the science to answer that question, but I have the snottiness to raise it. the things we really ought to be thinking. One of the reasons you can't dig yourself out of a cul-de-sac is you haven't put all the pieces on the table. So just to dig a few more pieces out. So I don't know, but I'm not willing to cede that human evolution and human technology are basically, you know, joined at the hip. That may be so, it may not be so. And if there are other choices, what generates them and in what goals? But these are exactly the hard questions that need to be asked with some leverage. Yeah.
So all these worlds, these different worlds that you've given us, like, it's all new to me. And but something that you're saying is really connecting to my heart. And you said, like, to live in world 48, but the rules of world 24.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that, whatever it's called,
yeah.
Nifa Shah
mm-hmm.
thing. So I feel like I've had some access to that,
yep.
from a suffering standpoint with, like,
yep.
in 2013 when my daughter died.
Yeah.
She wasn't sick, she just was going to school, and bam, you know, then she's life-flighted to the hospital, and 5 days later, whatever it is, she dies, and, like, it's, you know, standing at the bed and all of that pain, but to keep this aperture open between our hearts and,
yeah.
you know, that understanding that as a mother, you know, her blood and my blood all, like, intermixed and
yeah.
it's still, like, there. And, so I feel like I have some access to that line, or you know, I don't know how to describe it if it makes any sense. Sometimes I feel like I'm losing my brain, but
yeah.
I like there is something in that world that I feel very concretely, you know, and it's that love that I feel like you were sharing about Rafe or something.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's so tangible.
April, I knew there was a reason that you guys came, but yes, you're breaking my heart, but this is exactly so, and I knew the story. I mean, I've known the story. What it was a freak accident? Somebody hit her on the road? Or
was she was on her way to school.
Yeah.
In a car.
Yeah.
In her
yeah.
high school. And,
and
a young person, you know, wanted to go way faster. I mean, you see the tire marks on these roads. And yeah, it's...
There it is. What you and Steve have done with that tragedy... in the 7 years that I've known you, has been one of my deepest understandings of what living the Paschal Mystery has been, that you haven't gone to bitterness or victimization or fear, that you've taken it to a extraordinary place. And when I said hope means yes in the imaginal, I'm only half joking. I wasn't surprised when I invited you and immediately the answer was yes. No, well, are we wearing masks? Are we, you know, it was yes. Because yes, there's something you saw and there's something that you worked with and the aperture opened and your daughter's death was your death. And your daughter's resurrection is your resurrection. And that's exactly how it works. And she lives in you and you live in her. as the highest possible gift, and the blood that flowed, that mingled when she was in your womb, is now the blood of the Handblazine, as he said it, the blood of the second body, flowing between from either side. So yeah, you know it. And it brings forth in you exactly the commodity, exactly the quality that I'm talking about. And I see it in Bob too. It's the people that in a quiet way can live with death behind them, because they've been there. And it can't go boo and make them keel over. Because there's a continuity of life carried in the love that bridges the realms. And you can sense the angels ascending and descending in every moment. And it's the missing abundance that lets us live life. You know, the tragedy is that we're all mostly slightly too scared to live life. It feels slightly too big and dangerous a place, or we might get hurt. And there's something lacking, and if we could just be a little bit more courageous or a little bit more... And then boom, a death like that will take everything you wanted. And somehow you survive out the other end. And that peace that you could never find when it was all going well is suddenly there. And damn it, you've got it. That's exactly the quality. And that quality, if we could multiply it, I think in 20 souls, we change the planet instantly. Because it's powerful, you know. It's extremely powerful. You're not reckless, you're not pushy, you're not on a soapbox, but just to look at your eyes and your being, and anyone can tell you know exactly what you're talking about, and that it's grounded in the depths. So, thank you for that. Yeah, that's the heart beating. And when we dig in Thursday on what does it mean to really take responsibility for your own death, and to walk through it, and to move out the others in still that side. That's what living in World 48 from the perspective of World 24 is all about. You know, nothing can really take you. Nothing can blow you away. Nothing can blow you over, because you know it's all just nothing compared to what still is. So thank you. Thank you for saying what I couldn't say. I think we're beginning to see in this web today bits and pieces of what this miracle might look like when we get beyond platforms and schemes and scenarios and, you know. But it comes in these funny tastes. These funny tastes like what you've just said. This funny taste of Bob sitting there after a 8-month brutal struggle with cancer and its aftermath, teaching from everything that has been fired and tempered and gentled and cured in your soul, and teaching with the extraordinary sublime humility, one of the most beautiful lessons on helplessness and strength that's ever been taught anywhere. You know, this is what imaginal transformation is all about. You know, and this is what our lives are for. To do just this sort of stuff when it lands on our plate. Yeah, buddy?
I'd just like to briefly mention a couple topics or subjects, I guess, involving Eva Lee. For those who looked at the PDFs that were submitted, you know that I have been representing her in a matter in criminal prosecution. And she is now a convicted felon, serving a sentence of probation. You can read about it. What I wanted to say, though, is without going into all the details, but which I almost everything's public. When COVID hit, it was she pled guilty to making false statements to the National Science Foundation regarding an administrative report. You know, there's something traditional within our criminal justice system, the American criminal justice system, referred to as prosecutorial discretion. Not every crime's prosecuted, not every person's prosecuted who commits a crime. There's the ability within the system to weigh whether to do it or not to do it. As an aside, dealing with the issues of racial injustice within the so-called justice system, I'm a strong believer, since my career, almost now 45 years, has been devoted to the criminal justice system of practicing law. The system itself is a very fair system. It's the administration of the system of justice by humans that is unfair. Whether it be the politics of a particular person, whether it be racism or whatnot. But that gets to what I wanted to tell you, because I'm hoping everyone will have compassion in their listening to Eva this evening. Whether there had been justification in the initiation of the investigation and ultimately its prosecution, I made a concerted effort post-guilty plea to get the U.S. Attorney's Office to dismiss the case, not unlike what has happened with Michael Flynn. In fact, using Michael Flynn as an example of why it should happen with her. The Red Dawn material had come out. I had an Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert Cadillac, write a letter directly to the U.S. Attorney. I had the Chief Medical Officer of the Department of Homeland Security, Duane Kaneva, writing letters. I had other government, U.S. government officials. I had a lot of non-U.S. government officials. Ultimately, it was rejected. The U.S. attorney is a man born and raised, born in Seoul, Korea, raised in the United States. Through intermediaries and other sources, the feedback was clear. The Department of Justice, Bob, the Assistant Attorney General, the Attorney General, but more particularly the President, because this case got up that high. It wasn't going to happen. It wasn't going to happen because Eva Lee is of Chinese ethnicity. She was born in Hong Kong some 52 years ago. Her parents had fled communist China, as Mao Zedong had killed her grandparents and taken their land and destroyed their all aspects of their life. So they fled to Hong Kong with, as we always hear, the American story, but there's the Chinese story with just the clothes on their back. She was raised in abject poverty, but became known to some nuns and who got her into parochial schools. And she is brilliant, off the charts brilliant. And that became well known. And from then on out, her career brought her into the United States. She became an American citizen. But the reason that the U.S. Department of Justice would not dismiss the case and would hang around her neck, being a convicted felon, notwithstanding what she has done and continues to do on behalf of all of us, is because of her ethnicity. She's Chinese. And so there's racial injustice. And I wanted to bring this out to this group because getting back to what I personally feel is such a wonderful aspect about the wisdom seekers is to learn the compassion, to be open, to be fair-minded. So she's not just a world-renowned scientist with all this. As Rebecca says, she's an empath. She feels others' pain. But she herself has felt the pain of being mistreated by the system of justice because of not what she did, but what she was born, who her parents were. It's the different type of injustice, but it's racism nonetheless. So I just wanted to say that, and as you will hear her, just because I think she's a very extraordinarily courageous woman. And, you know, the fight's not over. We're dealing now with the NSF. We're dealing with Georgia Tech. And but she's out here wanting, being willing to speak to even us.
Yeah.
So I find her to be a very courageous person.
Thank you, buddy, for bringing that forward. And again, to look at the extraordinarily privileged nature of this gathering in this way, that this tiny little group of miscellaneous seekers here should be crossing paths with some major currents that are going on in the political world as it entwines with the, you know, the health world. I mean, that we've got in the microcosm tonight these two things, the political system and the pandemic, all, you know, being incarnated before us in this, you know, essentially miraculous, fortuitous invitation that Buddy and Rebecca have been able to orchestrate for us, to actually talk to the scientist and see what kind of clarity and insight we can get in a world which is so badly fractured and held hostage by biases and blindnesses of all sorts. You know, racism, scientism, you know, it's a rugged place. So thanks for throwing that in. I think it does help clarify and deepen the import of what this is. It's not just a random, you know, yet another Zoom conversation we can have. There's an exchange that could potentially happen here if you guys are alert to it. Anything else going on in people's hearts and minds? Another good day of work. So take a dinner break, and we're going to be, for all who wish to, we'll be at Bill Espinosa's again for the video will step off. Eva will be on promptly at 7:45, right? So we'd like to have everybody there and get sort of set up and ready to go by as much ahead of that as you need. Yeah, Bill?
It's good to say, I think that Bob and I were looking at there. The situation is not ideal, it's workable. But I would say, I think that there's something to be said for having two or three different locations for this.
Yeah.
Because I think getting 16 people or 17 people right into the relatively narrow area where we're going to be able to see and hear and speak might be a little difficult.
Yeah.
Bob, you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know who's brought their own computer with them. I mean, Zoom is set up so that if you can get onto the internet and you have a computer, you know, you can be there. The TV doesn't, we did successfully make a Zoom connection and the TV can be the display, but even though it's a fairly large screen, it would be a stretch to have all 16 there.
And so I have a computer and down at the inn, and the room that they gave me has a little sitting area, so I could easily comfortably seat five people if people wanted to stay in town. I mean, I don't have to, obviously,
yeah.
But probably six if we wanted.
Great.
I mean, it's got a couch and two armchairs. And
I also have a computer and space. It's inside, but we can open the windows.
Yeah. Okay, so if we could... if we could then sort of...
Would it be possible to do it here, or is this...
Well,
there's not a Wi-Fi, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't think they have a Wi-Fi connection here.
Right.
So if we had
the
of course, the advantage of being with the big group is that you have more of a visceral sense of the energy of the thing and, the group together. But if there was a pod that sort of was... You're in the Harvard, Tim?
Yeah.
Which room are you?
It's
Heritage.
Heritage. Is that one of the upstairs rooms? Or
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Just one thought. If Bill's internet could support it, we could take a couple of laptops and put them at the table and just keep it all muted and have the... So there's multiple people seeing.
If it could support it, that's the big if, I think. You know, what do you think about how many...
Does anybody have a hotspot? Do you have a hotspot?
I have a hotspot.
So you can do a hotspot here.
We could, using your phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's basically
that
part of our life.
As long as we mute the two computers.
Yeah.
Yeah, they would just need to mute it, but I think it would pretty good probably,
I don't think it would hurt the bandwidth.
I don't know.
I don't think it would hurt the bandwidth, and if you have a hotspot, that could be a backup.
We got a hotspot. At least we're going to make it.
Well, so maybe what we could do then, maybe we could have a group that goes to Osmosis, and another group that stays here with Bree in the hotspot, and maybe Timmy and Jimmy could join that group, and that.
So what was the decision?
What are you saying?
We could have one group that goes.
So your house is just down the street.
Yeah, my house is just three houses down.
So we tried it at your place, and it.
And if getting back here will take you less than a minute.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, that's good. So
I'll be here with my hotspot.
There you go.
So keep your hotspot and your computer in tow. And if we can make it work at Bill's, I think it would be lovely to have the group together. I mean, we can always, if we can run a computer, put one set in the living room and one set in the dining room.
Yeah, third.
Pardon?
Bring everybody to Bill's.
Yeah, bring your computer in the
past.
And if not, we can ship a group of us out to up here.
Yeah, what we are going to have to do, I think, if we're going to do this,
of course,
just have one source of sending questions back.
Right.
And that could be Bob's phone or somebody's.
Mm-hmm.
Or your computer.
Or my computer. Mm-hmm. And that then there would be only one talking possibility out.
What I would suggest that the person... if we're going to begin, when we get the dialogue part, yeah. She's going to do some little yeah. presentation. The person just comes to the computer, so she can see the person
Perfect.
As they present their question.